This is the Baby Bathwater Podcast, an exceptionally unscripted and underproduced adventure within entrepreneurial reality. Hosted by Hollis Carter and Michael Lovitch, co-founders of the Baby Bathwater Institute and the most reluctant podcasters this side of the Mississippi.
All right. So very exciting day here on the Baby Bathwater Podcast. We have an awesome guest that I met through one of our members, Dave Cherna from No Barriers, but had heard his name before and actually had a copy of his book in our office for quite some time, and heard many rumblings and was excited when we got to connect a few months back, and now finally having him here for a recorded conversation that we can share with all of you. So let's do a quick little intro here because his accomplishments do deserve a bit of an intro, and I think this will be a fun conversation. So Eric Weimerman is a pretty accomplished athlete in the world, having climbed the Seven Peaks, being the first blind man to actually climb Everest, losing his vision at 14. And so we'll get into a lot of this conversation here, but there are barriers that he has overcome that most people with all of their senses wouldn't even dream of doing. He's doing these without having his vision, which I'm excited to relate some of this to the entrepreneurial world and dealing with barriers and things as they come along. So I'll include some notes in the show notes and things where you can see more about, you know, the films that have been made about him and the article in Time magazine where they state that there is no way to put what Eric has done in perspective, because no one has ever done anything like it. It is a unique achievement and one that is trusted in pushing him to the limits that no man is capable of. So really excited to have you here. Excited to dive into some stuff. Eric, thanks for being here.
Cool. Psyched too. Thanks for the invite.
Got it. And Eric's here, I believe, in Colorado as well.
Yeah, I'm in Golden. So I'm just down the road.
Great.
And it's good because it's kind of a cloudy, snowy day. So good time to be inside doing a podcast.
Yeah. And we kind of have the spring floating in and out right now. I was like out in shorts and no shirt in the backyard the other day, and then it snowed a few hours later.
Yeah. And then I was up skiing in Vail yesterday and it was full on snowing the whole day and nice powder finally. So yeah, we got our Colorado activities to look forward to.
Yeah, it's wonderful. There's a handful of members. We did a 4:30 start and did Bear Peak on Sunday to get up there for sunrise. And they've been sticking to it pretty much every Sunday. It's kind of cool.
Oh, that's cool.
A little chunk of church.
Oh, yeah, that's kind of a rocky. I think I did it once. It's kind of a rocky. I don't think blind people would enjoy that, but I think I've done it. And isn't it a little bit scrambly?
Scrambly just at the end.
Okay.
But actually, the scramble is kind of all coated in ice and snow, so you just give some light spikes. It's actually
right,
it more sucks in the middle when that snow melts and it's like muddy, scrambly.
Oh right, yeah, uh-huh, nice.
So awesome. Maybe we tackle the very beginning here, being this whole thing that you climbed Everest and kayaked the Grand Canyon, and I think those are two things that most people listening is probably, you know, have watched movies about, read books about, have never pondered even doing it on their own, and, you know, they can see. just maybe a little story from the horse's mouth here about that, what drove you to do it, and would love just a little bit more, you know, quick background.
Yeah.
How that happened.
Well, it's funny that you like ask me this, you know, because yeah, if I read about somebody who was blind and climbed Mount Everest and kayaked the Grand Canyon, I'd be like, you know, holy shit, you know, that's insane. But because it's me, I'm like, I don't know, it's just me. I don't think it's that big a deal, I guess. You know, it's like, I know I'm just an average person. I'm a driven athlete, but I'm not like a super, super talented athlete. I can be a huge procrastinator sometimes, but also, you know, there are certain ideas that just gnaw at my brain that I have to pursue. And I guess, you know, I feel compelled to grow through that experience and try to build the map or the template in terms of how to get that crazy thing done. And so I guess I'm not really like an adrenaline junkie or somebody who like loves risk and, you know, loves to cheat death or anything like that. That's not me. I'm very methodical. I'm very scared, actually. You know, like when I'm skiing, I'm nervous, you know, I'm thinking about those trees out there that are waiting for me, you know? So I guess nobody's immune to this human being, life equation. All I know is that I was a teacher. I loved teaching. I was a middle school teacher. I taught sighted kids in Arizona. I loved it so much. I could have done it forever. But I also had this nagging idea that I could make a life in the mountains and in the rivers as an adventurer. And, you know, that wasn't something venture capitalists would have probably invested in, you know, the blind climbing adventure business. But I couldn't get it out of my head. And I just thought maybe there is like a way to do it. And I had a bit of a safety net because my dad was, he'd worked in New York City and he was retiring. And he was pretty young still. He was like 55. And he said, hey, I'll be your manager and I'll like try to help you figure out some of the business stuff that I didn't really have great skills in the business world at that point, being a teacher. And so I knew I had my dad's support. And that was really great because, you know, you got to have people that believe in you. You know, the lone wolf thing where it's like, I'm going to do this no matter what anyone says. No, it's not normally like that. You got to have a couple people that say, yeah, I buy into this idea. I believe in you. I think you can do this. And if you fail, you can go back to teaching. And if you succeed, then great. Maybe it lasts 5 years, maybe it lasts 10 years. Well, that was in 1997. I've been climbing and adventuring for over 20 years now.
Yeah, no, it's funny. Azari, I know that's just like the viral soundbite that is just so easy to put into it, but I'm sure from your shoes, like, yeah, that's just part of a bigger, more complex me, which I did like when I read that, you know, people say that you're a blind climber and you're like, no, look, I'm a climber who happens to be blind. And, you know, for those who that bigger soundbite lands, and it's such a curiosity point, could you unpack just a little bit about that? Because like, I know as being a skier and a climber and stuff as well, like there's certain things that you love from that. And there's just this coincidence that you figure out how to do it and like how you personally sit with that, because I have a feeling you have a nice relationship with it. That's probably different than people's gut, you know, knee jerk reaction when they hear that.
Yeah. Well, again, with Everest, you know, it took me a long time. I was climbing the seven summits, the tallest mountain in every continent. I had read this book called The Seven Summits by Dick Bass, who was kind of a hero of mine. He was the first person to do it, the tallest mountain in every continent. Mm-hmm. And I got pretty blown away by that. Like, that'd be cool to go around the world and like live this great adventure, traveling and adventuring and training. And I just thought that would be such an exciting way to go. And then I thought, well, Everest, you know, maybe I get six out of the seven. Maybe I can't get Everest because, you know, it's one of these chicken or the egg things, you know, because a lot of people with sight were like, oh, you know, Everest, first of all, you know, there's sections that are so icy. The ice is, the snow is so bullet hard, you know, it's like thousands of year old ice exposed, mm-hmm. that if you fall, you cannot self-arrest. I mean, you can't throw your ice axe into the snow and stop yourself. And you're also, you know, you can't think up there because they call it the death zone. So you're not thinking very well. You're kind of, they say, reduced to like a reptilian brain. And so I'm like, well, if I rely on my brain all the time as a blind climber, trying to assess, okay, can I get down from this section? Am I going to be able to scramble down from this? You know, I have to be very, very focused on feeling every single step in front of me. Am I going to have time to get to the summit and get back down? Where's my energy level? All those things. If you lose all that ability to assess and you can't see, you know, what an overwhelming combination against you. And so I had to climb a lot, you know, like I had to put in the time. I had to, you know, climb Mount Adams, the north face of Adams, where we left at like 4 in the morning. And then we summited and, did get back down till 4 the next morning, you know, these endless marathon, crazy hard days, you know, navigating around open crevasses and technical climbing rock and ice. And before I felt, you know, like maybe I had what it took, like in terms of I'd earned the confidence, the right to at least try. And then I had several friends who had climbed Everest or had attempted it and said, you know, look, dude, I don't care what, you know, these naysayers say, they're judging you on blindness, what they know about blindness, but they don't know you. They haven't seen you in action. And I think you've earned the right to at least try Everest. So I had to have that confidence in my brain. Like, you know, I'm not just like throwing myself at the wall and hoping I stick, you know, like I had to go through the training to know whether I had the confidence and I felt like I had earned the right to be there. Same thing with the Grand Canyon. You know, I was just really fascinated by the idea of, could a blind person figure out how to navigate this insanity of this riverscape where things are happening to you so fast? You're getting pulled from one part of the river to the other. You're slamming into rocks. You're spinning around. You're reacting so fast. You can't see anything coming. Would a blind person be able to navigate and maybe even from time to time flourish in that environment? Like, is that possible? And that's so intrigued me to know. Like, I thought, okay, maybe I'm the guy for the job, but if it's not me, it's going to be somebody else. So maybe I should just pursue this as far as I can. And then the key is, as I said earlier, is to find the people who want to be a part of that journey with you. And if anything, the secret weapon for me has not been being this extraordinary person, but having, and I know it sounds a little cheesy, but just having gratitude for the people that come into your life that mentor you, because I've always been so lucky to be able to attract these amazing people. Maybe they're, you know, they're in their 50s or something and they've done amazing stuff in their field. And they say, hey man, like guiding a blind person down the Grand Canyon, that would be such a cool thing to do. I want to pursue this with you. I want to explore this with you. And I want to figure out how far we can take this together. And we'll kind of build the map together. We'll engineer the map together through a lot of questions without answers.
Right, right. No, that's funny. That's what I was hoping we would kind of go with this, knowing that none of us really go out alone, whether we're building a business or, you know, rafting and kayaking the Grand Canyon and doing those kind of things. It requires a team. And
certainly blind people don't climb Everest or kayak the Grand Canyon alone, at least not yet.
Right. Not sure. No, I was reading some of this stuff before we got in this. I was just thinking about it and how this applies to our, you know, entrepreneurial world and how you have to be able to compensate for places where we might not strive. And, you know, I'm crazy dyslexic and can barely spell and do math and write. And so that's like, it slows me down when I have to do those tasks, but there's people on the team who are amazing at that and help make up for it.
Yeah.
And when I was mostly curious about the two, obviously you have your two big things, the Grand Canyon and Everest, of even before we got to the team, of how you think about, you know, I always remember the Knowles quote, the proper prior planning prevents piss poor performance. And wondering what prep looks like in your mind when you're like, you have this idea, and I have a feeling you just get an itch, and once you decide you're going to scratch it, a whole slew of things start happening. Yes. And what prep in your mind and planning phase looks like for you, for whether it's no barriers, which we'll get to in a minute, or tackling a mountain or a river.
Yeah. So, I mean, what I mentioned earlier in terms of the team, I think that comes first. You know, like when I started thinking about Everest, I knew I had to find somebody who knew what the heck they were doing in the Himalayas. I'd never been to the Himalayas. So I was at this outdoor conference, I think in like Salt Lake City or something. And somebody introduces me to this guy named Pasquale. He's PV for short, Pasquale Vincent, PV. Mm-hmm. And he had done tons of Himalayan expeditions. And we started talking and he had like this big smile. I could sense, you know, I could hear his smile. And he was just like, dude, you ever think of Everest? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, dude, you want me to lead your team? I'm like, yeah. So it was very bro, but I found this guy and he was great. And he had such energy. We started training and planning. I think we planned for 2 years. And I'd been climbing, you know, half my life before that. So I really believe in putting in the time, but, PV was this guy that had just this boundless energy and enthusiasm and optimism. And it wasn't like he was naive. And I've learned this about leaders. It's not like you're naive. You know, it's not like you're looking at an avalanche coming down and it's about to crush you. And you're like, oh, let's look on the bright side. You know, that's ridiculous. But what they are able to do is to see these really hard, hard things and these incredible obstacles and pitfalls, and then somehow believe through it. So they're like realistic optimists. And it's really cool to watch them in action. And PV was that kind of guy. He said he had dreams of us every single night, climbing over the Hillary Step together and side by side reaching the summit together. And that dream, he'd wake up sometimes with tears in his eyes. And I thought, man, I mean, that's like, if you're lucky enough to dream about something every night and wake up with tears in your eyes, I mean, you're motivated. So I was so lucky to find somebody like PV. And then we started building the team. It was people that PV felt comfortable with, who knew the Himalayas and knew Everest. And then I picked some of the guys that were comfortable guiding me and knew my abilities, like what I needed and what I didn't. And so we started training from there. And then we really wanted to be, a really strong team. You know, on Everest, a lot of times people go up there and they're just like one person and they join this team of, they're not even teams. They're kind of these loose confederations of individuals that have all paid into this kind of support logistical team, but they're not really going to lay it out there for each other. I knew if I was going to do Everest safely, I wanted a team that were willing to lay it out there for each other. So we trained a ton as a team and we bled a lot as a team. And we really put the 2 years in to the whole thing. And we actually even went to a peak called Amada Blam, which is a peak about 10 miles from Everest. It's a very steep, forbidding peak. And we got our butts kicked on that peak. Big, terrible storms. And we couldn't even stand up. But one of the guys on our team fell and we had to evacuate him down the mountain. And it was turned into a big rescue. And, you know, people were like, you tried this other peak and you didn't even come close. What makes you think you're going to climb Everest? Well, guess what? You know, the mountain had erected a very powerful barricade in our path. And it was actually by crossing through it that we became a team. We weren't a team. We were good climbers, but we weren't a team. And so that like thing you always hear about, a little bit of a cliche, you know, like the team, the parts aren't like as strong as the team itself. You know what I mean? But that is true because the team takes on this kind of amorphous strength as a collective. And we needed to go through that to have that collective, you know, where we knew how we could rely on each other and trust each other and commit to each other. So like when I came down from Everest, I sat in my tent with my crampons on. I was in the vestibule with my, you know, crampons in the snow, just sitting there waiting for every person on my team to come down the mountain, because I don't care if I'm blind or not, I was going to go out there and help carry somebody in if they needed that support. You know, we made that commitment to each other. And I think that's why 19 of us out of 21 reached the summit, because everyone wanted to be a part of that thing that we had worked so hard to achieve and wanted to be a part of seeing me get to the top. So that's unheard of, that a team of 21, 19 get to the summit. That's like, you've never been seen before.
Wow. And in that situation, since you were like the originator of the idea and driving it, did you view yourself and feel the pressures and kind of desire to be the leader of this group? Were you looked to as the leader in this, or how was the dynamics among this group of 21 folks?
I think it's too much pressure to see yourself as the leader, you know, because I hadn't had Himalayan experience at that point. So PV was really our more logistical leader in so many ways, but maybe I was like the the spiritual leader or something like that in the team.
Leader, yeah.
But, you know, I couldn't compete with all these amazingly strong climbers who could see, you know, I'm not the fastest. I'm not the smartest. I didn't have the most experience. But I think for me, leadership is, I try to bring it down to a little bit of a more base element, which is, have I today contributed in some way to getting the team a little higher up the mountain, you know? And if I can say yes, then yeah, I'm leading. I'm part of the leadership of that team. You know, I'm contributing to us getting a little higher up the mountain. I mean, and sometimes it's like you forget about the little things, right? Like dishing up some food for somebody and serving it to them, or you know, when they're out doing something, you take, open their pack and you blow up their air mattress and you lay out their sleeping bag, or you carry a little bit of weight, you know, out of their pack when they're feeling sick, or somebody is sick and you just sit up with them all night long, just making sure they're okay. You know, so I think people get carried away with the idea of leadership. Are you the ultimate leader? Well, yeah, everyone can lead and everyone can follow.
I love that, because, you know, it's something that Michael and I talk about a lot, is there's this like entrepreneurial heroism that's been made through social media with the Gary Vaynerchuks and the Elon Musks and all this stuff, where it's all them. But generally, that's not actually the truth of how it works. There's this entire team that's doing lots of pieces and parts for it to happen. And I love your view on it, where it's little, it could be the smallest things that actually create leadership, as long as they're moving it forward.
And one thing I've been good at is getting the funding too. So that's a part of the leadership piece. You know, I went to the National Federation of the Blind and we met the president at the time, me and PV. And he was like, you know, he was really funny. And I don't want you to take this out of context, because I really totally agree with what he said. But you have to really kind of think about it and relate to it. But he's like, could you die up there? And I'm like, well, I could, but I'm not planning on it. He said, good, because I don't want to support something where you're a blind guy and you're going to get carried to the summit and spiked on top like a football. He's like, I want you to be a real part of the team, and have the, you know, you put your boots on in the morning, you take the risks that other people take on the team. And that was really powerful. So he said, yeah, we'll support this, because, you know, like when you think of blindness, what do you think of? And I said, well, probably Helen Keller. And he said, well, yeah, she died in 1968. So blindness needs a facelift. And when people think about blindness, I want them to think about somebody standing on top of the world. And I thought, okay, I can do that. I can try. But yeah, there's a lot of pressure, as you mentioned, because I had a lot of people, you know, kind of taking their hopes and dreams and carrying it with me up the mountain. And so I knew that if I flopped on my face, you know, like I was going to let a lot of people down. But at the same time, you really just have to be super focused up there, not think about all those other external pressures, because that can sabotage your brain.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where a lot of people will find some relatedness to this, who aren't maybe tackling Everest, but there's so many similarities. You know, they might be raising money and building a team, and they're setting some crazy vision and getting people on board for it and doing it. And I know I've felt it, and I know those in the group have, is there can be that pressure that can almost work against you to find that flow and that focus when you think about all the people depending on you and stuff like that, which, you know, I am curious if you've developed, you know, coping mechanisms or strategies or things that you do to stay in the zone, to get what needs to be done, knowing that you can have this circle going through your head of all the conversations you had and the people that are watching and following and depending on you up to that point.
Well, I think about focusing myself on what's the most important thing. So if you're Elon Musk, it's like getting a rocket launched safely and down, right? And if you succeed in that, everything else will come along with it. So I've had teammates that have gotten distracted with the social media and the fundraising and the communicating with sponsors. And I'm like, no, if we summit this mountain or we achieve our goal, everything else will come along with it. So I got to stay focused on being the very best prepared I can for that event, for that big expedition. So that's one thing that I do. I just like try to have laser focus on what is the most important thing, because like on Everest, the Buddhists, the Sherpas and the Tibetans, they have a saying. They say the nature of mind is like water. If you do not disturb it, it will become clear. And, you know, not to get carried away with that statement, but it is really cool, because what it's saying is like, you're trying to stay clear, right? Like in Western terminology, we're talking about the flow, right? The zone, whatever mm-hmm. You want to call it, right? But, and so you get all these other things, like other responsibilities or other fears and doubts and pressures, and they clutter your brain and they weigh you down and they sabotage you. And so how do you keep your mind clear like water, like still water, you know, just getting all that mud and crap out of your brain and focusing on the very most important thing. And that part of that is just being in the moment, being the very best you can be at that moment. And then making sure you celebrate every step along the way. And so that really, I thought, was very helpful. The other thing I think for me is, I was an English major and I read the Odyssey and those stories are metaphors for lots of things. And so Odysseus is coming home from the Trojan Wars and he passes the island of the Sirens, these maidens that call out to the sailors with such beautiful voices that they jump off the ship and they swim to the island trying to get to these beautiful melodious voices. And it turns out the sirens are monsters and they gobble them up and they're never seen again. And Odysseus puts wax in his ears and ties himself to the mast and makes it through. And that's your brain. Basically, I think that is a metaphor for the brain, because when you're doing something really big, doesn't matter what it is, like laying it out there with a business idea or climbing a mountain or kayaking the Grand Canyon, you are going to feel so overwhelmed. It's just part of the equation. I don't know anybody who can go through it without feeling massively overwhelmed. And so when you feel overwhelmed in that way, you kind of retreat to this amygdala part of the brain where it's fight or flight, and you want to retreat. And you're like, there are cheeseburgers, there are French fries waiting for me down there. Like I don't have to be here. And so it's very easy to give in to the allure of those monsters that call you down from whatever your dream is. And so I think I've learned that even the brain can sabotage you. It's a biological thing, you know, with hormones and chemicals and things like that running through your brain, and it wants to keep you safe and alive. It almost borders on a kind of spirituality, because are you the brain? Are you the hormones and chemistry running through your brain? Or are you something deeper? And I choose to believe that it's the thing I want to be is deeper. And you could call it a soul or a light or the human spirit or whatever it is. But I try to tap into that deeper thing and say, that's who I want to be. I don't know if I'll ever be that person, but that's who I strive to be. And so that keeps me focused, I think, sometimes, and moving in the right direction.
No, I love that. And I like how you referenced multiple times the different labels and words we've put on this thing that allows us to accomplish the goal there, whether it's flow or the, you know, the clear mind, like water. And I think, you know, I listen to a lot of Alan Watts stuff, and he talks about the mind that worries about worrying and gets in that vicious circle. Yeah. And going back to your prep, what you basically were like, what I was taking from alluding to is, you know, the things that need to get done. It obviously takes a whole team. And if you can find yourself focusing on that thing, despite all the chemical reactions and overwhelm when you're in the moment of actually accomplishing the job, all that prep can kind of pay off because you can center in on the thing you need to do.
Yeah.
And I really liked your little things, or maybe that thing is that the team needs to work together in order to accomplish a big goal. So I do need to take someone's weight, or I do need to could be stay up late with this person who needs some help, because them being a part of this integral thing is more important, and figuring that all out. So I think it's cool, because this whole like concept of being in flow, you're tapping in on that, and that's being something that's almost being commercialized now, in a way that I think has applied for generations and generations, and just as different labels put on it, and you're articulating it well.
And it does take some, you know, luxury to be able to do that, you know, to be able to focus on that one thing. So yeah, it is great to have that team of people who can help you out, you know. Even when like I wrote my last book, you know, I was like, look, I'm going to write all day. I'm not going to get distracted by like 1,000 things, because it's so easy to get distracted and then you never finish the book. So if I want to write this book and make it the best it can possibly be, that's what I need to focus on right now. And so I would tell my team, I was very lucky to have a team of, I just have a small team of 2 people that work with me. But I was like, really try to take as much off my plate as possible, because I'm literally going to sit at my desk and write for 8 hours a day. I, you know, if I have to focus on 12 things, I'm never going to finish this.
Oh yeah. I'm seeing the patterns emerging of how you've accomplished what you've done is, you know, faith in the team, focus on the goal, and keeping the mind centered on what you planned on. And knowing what the key levers are that need to be pulled and need to be done.
Yes.
So, I mean, we've talked a lot about the things that you've done well. I'm super curious to hear if you have some epic failure lessons of things that have gone awry, or you've had to call it quits on, or and lessons from that.
Yeah, you know, you fail. If you're a good climber, you fail 50% of the time. You know, if you're summiting, well, I mean, even there are people who like set their sights on these outlandish goals, and they succeed like 10% of the time. So if you're succeeding all the time, you might be, maybe you're choosing things that are too easy.
In that mountaineering world, calling it quits is something that is sometimes just preserving life, and it is, and it's part of that. And obviously,
yeah, sometimes it's black and white. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it is black and white, you know, like, okay, so I was sitting at the base of this incredible ice face that we had a dream to climb. It's a 3,000-foot ice face, and it's vertical and then even overhanging at the top, like giant mushrooms of ice that you're climbing up and over. And we sat at the base of that mount of that ice face in the Himalayas. And I think it was like at 4 a.m. or 3 a.m, it was like 28 degrees. That means it's probably going to get to like 55 degrees that day. Now there's these giant gun barrels of ice just looming at the top of that face. And if they break off, they're going to come right down the face and kill everything and everyone on that face. So I'm like, okay, the odds are, 80% chance we climb this face, and then 20% chance that one of these giant chunks of ice comes down and kills us. I mean, what, you know, that's a pretty easy decision, even though it's painful. But I think there are also moments where you look at a face and then the conditions change, right? Like I went to climb Mount Kenya, and it's supposed to be a sunny rock climb. And it's at 17,500 feet. And we got there and it was totally covered with snow. And the cracks that you'd put, you know, jam your hands in and stuff were choked with ice. Now, not great conditions for climbing, but we actually wound up failing. But could we have summited if we changed our approach? I think we could have. So I think sometimes it's, you know, failure is, you call it quits because your expectations of that change, and you can't wrap your head around the new circumstances. So the mountain isn't ever going to change. It's going to do what it's going to do. So you have to change your own approach. So in that case, I always look back at that climb and say, we could have summited if we had said, okay, we're going to carry more weight. We're going to bivvy on the side of the mountain. We're going to slow it down. We're going to bring different kind of equipment, you know? So we could have done it. So yeah, that's why I'm saying calling it quits sometimes is not necessarily black and white. It's more of a psychological beatdown. You're just psychologically beaten down and you're like, I'm ready to go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that's a wonderful transition to talking a bit about no barriers and what your experience in life led you to do that. Because, you know, that's a pretty large business that's been built around major obstacles. And I think that I have a feeling the physical is just a way to help with the psychological. And I would love to know where the first thought came from and what the idea seed that led it to what it is today is, and maybe talk about just how that first kind of percolated in your mind. So we can go into that.
Well, for sure. I mean, no barriers is the physical challenges, but also the invisible challenges, right? Because, you know, maybe this will make sense. There's, you know, there's a prosthetic when you're missing a leg, but where's the prosthetic for the mind, right? So the mind's way trickier. But it took us a little while to kind of get there. I guess the first thought of no barriers was really coming down from Mount Everest. You know, I got down the mountain, you know, every step counts, you know, and you're just crushed. You're crushed. And I got down through the ice fall, the Khumbu ice fall, which is a blind person's worst nightmare. And then we celebrated a bit and PV pulled me aside and he said, Eric, your life is about to change. And then he said, but do me a favor. He said, I want you to think about this. Don't let this mountain, don't let Mount Everest be the greatest thing you ever do. And that was hideously timed motivational advice, but
I remember you telling me that the first time we talked, and it does hit. It's just like so important, but delivered at a time of taking the wind out of my sails.
Phoebe doesn't always have good timing, but he's really quite deep and insightful, because what he's talking about, I think, you know, like reading David Brooks's content and books, I really like his stuff, you know, talking about, I think it's eulogy virtues versus resume virtues, you know, like, so PV was saying, like, look, I mean, a climb like this can become a trophy on your shelf, or it can mean something, or it can mean something. It can be a catalyst to something new. And you're, I think what he was telling me was your whole life is a growth process, right? You're trying to continue to grow every day of your life until the day you die. And so how is one experience teach you and help you in that journey? And so really, so no barriers, coming down the mountain, figuring out how to like take these big experiences and translate them into, like, you know, is there a template? Is there a map? Is there a way forward that you can, you know, take away for other people who have challenges? That was maybe the first step. And then the second step was, then because of that Everest notoriety, I got invited on a film project with this hero of mine. His name is Mark Wellman. Mark is a paraplegic, and he, in the 80s, he broke his back in a climbing accident, and he decided that he wanted to climb El Capitan. So him and his partner, they figured out this incredible pull-up system. Basically, he's doing pull-ups up the rock face with this pull-up bar that locks on to the rope by with these teeth called an ascender. And he did 7,000 pull-ups in 8 days and got to the top of El Capitan in Yosemite. And this is a 3,000-foot monolith. And, you know, he was as famous as you could get at that time, you know, was, you know, Tom Brokaw interviewed him. He was all over the Today Show. He lit the torch in the Olympics, Paralympics, you know, he met presidents, you know, and so that was a huge thing for me to get invited on a climb in this film project with Mark. And then he invited Hugh Herr, who is another phenomenon, another phenom. His name, he was a great climber in his day. Well, he's still a great climber, even though he's probably in his 50s now. And he lost his legs in a winter climbing accident. His legs froze and they had to be amputated. He got lost on the mountain. And Hugh went on to build these prosthetic legs and feet that enabled him to climb at a super high level. And so when I went rock climbing for this project with these two guys, I was like, okay, there's something to be taught here. Like, there's something I need to learn here. Like, these are two people that have been absolutely destroyed. They've been shattered. And somehow they figured out how to pick up the pieces and rebuild themselves into something stronger. And I, you know, I want to be part of that club. And I want to understand what it is that is inside people like this that I could take away and maybe teach to other people. And these are like these sort of, we call them at No Barriers, we call them elements. You know, like, for instance, how do you take the crap of life and turn it into, you know, into greatness? How do you pioneer your own systems and engineer your way forward, you know, when things aren't so obvious? How do you build the right teams around you to lift you up and support you along the way? How do you tap into that kind of light that I talked about earlier, you know, and really build that vision that's more internal than external and understand that internal makeup of what you're doing? And then how do you use it all to find a way to elevate the people around you and maybe your community and your family and your school and your, and the world in some way, you know, is like, cause what does it matter otherwise? So we started taking the, you know, these people that I had met and building it into a kind of a template that we could use to help other people break through barriers. And that really became the community of No Barriers. Like, how do we all lean in together as people with challenges? Every challenge under the sun, from first generation Americans to foster care kids, to blind people, to deaf people in wheelchairs, to people with anxiety and fear and trauma. How do you all lean in together and say, we are a collective force and we can solve our problems together if we just lean into each other? So that was really the idea of No Barriers. And yeah, we've been in existence now for 17 years. And yeah, we're flourishing in so many ways. It's been really fun to build that community and see the impact on people's lives.
Yeah, amazing. What was the first iteration from having that kind of moment of you realizing you wanted to provide this template and this structure and this, you know, support system for people? What was your first move when you went to attack this with your, you know, your, rather than having your Everest to attack,
yeah,
you had to set up your plan for this?
Well, it was really quite the same. So, but maybe harder in certain ways, because, you know, in a way, like a mountain or a river, okay, you got to navigate the rapids or you got to climb the mountain and you got to stay focused. But with, you know, when you're growing an organization, I had such little expertise in like the business world, you know, so it was things I didn't know. And so part of it was back to finding people that share that vision, that believe in what you're doing and then want to join you. And they're people with experience. And I think it's kind of a metacognition, you know, knowing what you don't know and being okay with that, knowing that you're vulnerable. And then, you know, you connect with the right people and you bring them aboard and they help you, they mentor you, they put you on the fast track. So in that way, it was more complicated than climbing or kayaking, but it started in a similar way. It was like you start with a bunch of questions that you don't have answers to, and you slowly just kind of put the pieces together and you blunder forward a little bit, because there's just absolutely no way to move forward in this perfect way. You got to blunder. You're going to bleed and flail, and you got to be okay with that. So yeah, our first attempts were a little bit of bleeding and flailing. Our first experience, we brought, we found this guy who, he had a connection in Cortina, Italy, believe it or not. And they were a town that were really looking for more tips and ideas of how to become a more inclusive town. It was like cobblestone streets and tiny little bathtubs and things that, like, you know, very inaccessible a town. And so we got a little bit of funding, and me and Mark and Hugh went over there. And we literally brought hand cycles, mountain hand cycles, and climbing equipment, and just basically did demos of how we do some of these things. I brought this device that I've been guinea pig for called the BrainPort. It's a device that a video camera takes a picture or video image, and that gets translated through a little computer, a microprocessor computer that I wear in my hand, and it translates to a tactile image on my mouth, like this retainer that has all these little vibrating pixels that I touched my tongue to it, and I'm essentially kind of seeing what the camera, I'm feeling what the camera is seeing. And it's all about neuroplasticity and how the brain works. It's super fascinating. So it, basically our first experience was just a show and tell. And then it took us a while to go, wait, what are we doing? Why aren't we involving people, right? Like, let's not have people just watch us do things. Let's involve people. And so that they can test these new ideas and technologies and adaptations in a real active outdoor environment. And so, yeah, it just was part of the iterative process of going, wait a second, wait a second. And there was a lot of wait a seconds in the last 17 years.
Right. I'm sure they're continuing to roll as you know, I see the different models that are tacked on it from having the books and the live events and the courses and continuing to find things that you can build teams around and, you know, expand the message. And it's been really cool to see from the inside. You guys are, and the impact you have is actually very real. And I think that's where it starts from, that original vision. And it's the tactics are just ways that you could scale it more.
Yeah, and you're right. The stories, the impact has been so powerful to me. I mean, there's a story I've told a lot, but I mean, I'm just still blown away. This guy, Matt Burgess, you know, he came to our program. He smoked. He'd been in the military, had a bunch of traumatic brain injuries. His brains were a little bit rattled. He'd had uranium poisoning on the battlefield. He had a bad reaction to the anthrax medication. He'd been sexually molested in the military. Like, he came to us. He was a mess. I mean, he wasn't really functioning. Mm-hmm. And so we took him through this no barriers process. And man, he tried to sabotage it a dozen times, you know, would storm off, and you challenge him a little bit, he'd storm off into the woods. And, you know, because he had all these coping mechanisms that weren't working for him. And darkness was familiar to him, right? And sabotage was familiar to him. All the stuff we were talking about was scary as hell. But he stuck with it, and he climbed the mountain with our team. And his no barriers pledge was to start Freedom Fighters. And he's trained 50 dogs now. They're therapy dogs for support dogs for kids and folks in the military. You know, dogs that will retrieve your phone for you and you know, wake you up at night if you're having if you're not breathing properly. Will, you know, do all kinds of amazing things. Right. For these folks. And he has a facility down in Georgia. And you know, the guy continues to, and his health continues to decline, but he just keeps firing forward with this beautiful sort of mission that he has and this purpose that, you know, I'm proud to say No Barriers had a little impact in him doing that.
That's amazing. And I think that's you fulfilling kind of, when you talked about PV, saying this shouldn't be your biggest accomplishment. Like, don't let this define you. And that the ripple effect that No Barriers has as you guys continue to deliver this message and actually tools and trainings and experiences that can allow, I mean, you could have just walked away from that and had that experience and had this cool resume calling card and had this great experience for yourself and your 21 people on the team. But now you pretty much figure out how to multiply the effect of it across other people. And I think that's something that is pretty powerful.
Yeah. And it's, you know, this idea of like selflessness or whatever, you know, it's I love the connection. You know, every human being, I think we're all looking for connection.
I love you brought that up, because when you were actually talking about that earlier with the team, where it's like, you know, people who are helping are also getting that. Like, I know when we host an event and everyone's kind of saying, thank you, it's great. It's great. I'm like, I got value from that too.
Totally. yeah. So we're all getting something out of it. And for me, right. like when I was going blind and sitting in the cafeteria, feeling like at a table by myself, listening to all the life passing me by. And I felt like I was in that prison that I, well, the world had put me in, sure, but I partly put myself in. Well, you see other people sitting in that prison and you're like, I relate to that. I don't know their personal situation, but I know what that prison feels like. And maybe I could help you break out. And that feels so good to be a part of that and be connected with that person. And it's a heart thing. It's not a mind thing.
Right. No, absolutely. And just having that empathy and understanding for yourself and for others, and knowing how those two kind of transition. And I think you guys have done an amazing job of it. And it's been fun talking to Dave as COVID happened and the events are changing, and just seeing how things can still be delivered.
Yeah. And we had to pivot on a dime, like every organization, do all these virtual events and so forth. And so, yeah, we have our big celebration of our No Barrier Summit. And usually, you know, we'll get like 1,000 people in this very cool mountain town, or we've even been to places like New York City. But we did it virtually, and I guess we marketed it pretty good. The team really did a great job, and we had 1.3 million views. So with COVID, in a weird way, there were sort of these unexpected gifts that even COVID, you know, forced us into recognizing.
Right. Yeah. No, I've had a lot of conversations recently with folks, especially entrepreneurs who've had to pivot everything and deal with lots of uncertainty, starting to see actually some cool value that's come out of things where they might've been complacent and have probably just stayed doing things the way they've always been done.
Exactly.
Now I've been able to reinvent things in some interesting ways.
Yeah. And whenever you have to reinvent things, I mean, it's painful at the time. So it's a total contradiction, because, you know, like I wrote this whole book on the adversity advantage, taking adversity and turning it into an advantage. And I co-wrote it with this guy, Dr. Paul Stoltz. And he was an expert on resiliency and adversity, helping to change people's relationship with adversity. He has all these tools and measurements to measure your relationship with adversity. And you know, and so I would argue with Paul. Paul's a genius, but I'd argue with him because I came at adversity through an anecdotal, like experiential side, and he came through it at a more of an academic approach. And so, you know, we'd arm wrestle a little bit, because I'd be like, dude, you're walking down the street and you stub your toe into the curb and the tip of your toe opens up and blood is just geysering everywhere. You don't look down at blood gushing out of your toe and go, what an opportunity for growth. You know, that's not your first thought. First thought is to lay on your belly and pound your fists on the ground and rail against how unfair this is, you know? But Paul's right. Like, the quicker you are able to respond in an effective way to that situation and use it as a growth opportunity, the better you're going to be, the healthier, the longer you're going to live. All that stuff is totally true. But your first reaction, I think, as a human being, is to scream and cry at the top of your lungs.
there's healthy reasons why these things exist in our biology. But I think, to your point, it is right. It's like building the conscious awareness of our reaction speed, which I think happens with time and repetition and understanding.
That bask in the loss for a bit, you know, that's part of the equation. I think basking in the loss, when Hugh Herr lost his legs, right? He didn't just like pop up and be like, okay, you know, that's so movie, you know, that's not real. You know, he told me he looked down at where his legs were supposed to be one day, and he wailed from as deep a place as pain could come from. And then over time, you know, as he began to experiment and explore, he looked down at where his legs were supposed to be, and instead of seeing loss, what he saw, he told me, was a blank canvas, and he could build in that blank spot, like whatever his mind could conceive. And so I think that's really, for me, like maybe the most important thing of No Barriers and even my life is like, how do you turn loss into growth, into love, into empathy, into, you know, like you look at these beautiful cliffs and towers in Moab, outside of Moab, Utah, and you realize that they were constructed by the wind, you know? And so, yeah, of course, adversity is going to have an effect on you, but maybe you can choose what you look like at the end of that process.
Totally. Yeah. And like, and it's never, it's just like you mentioned earlier, it's never black and white, right? But we have tools and frameworks and things that we put in place and constantly evolving and tinkering with them. Like, I'm sure with the template that you've evolved for No Barriers over the 17 years, it evolves and it's constantly changing as you learn more about how humans react and as, you know, psychological things that become more complex and also more tools and research and things become available.
Yes.
Which is what I'm kind of curious, because we have a fair amount of people in our community who are involved in like the psychedelic community. As you evolve yourself and through these groups, have you guys entered into those therapies and stuff? Or is that, where does that sit on the radar for you guys?
Well, maybe a year before COVID happened, we started a podcast. So we've interviewed a lot of people, you know, just trying to diagnose what their No Barriers life looks like, whatever comes from that, you know, really an authentic narrative of how somebody's broken through barriers in their lives. And one of them, you know, several of them have experimented with psychedelics and all kinds of amazing therapies that are pretty out there, you know? And so, yeah, we've explored some of that, but I haven't personally explored psychedelics. I've microdosed a few times, but I'm thinking about, because I mean, all of us, there's no way to get through what I'm 52 now without some trauma in your life that, you know, these like kind of circular messages or things that just keep swirling around in your life that you can't seem to kind of get past. And so is it ketamine that I've heard people go and do?
Yeah.
In a prescribed setting. And so I've honestly been thinking about doing that for maybe the last 6 months, that like maybe, because you know, the guy we interviewed that explored all these therapies, he talked really about integration, and it's so hard to find integration without psychedelics perhaps. So it's a really good tool perhaps to really feel fully integrated in my life. And so maybe at 52, I might go experiment with that.
Yeah, I'm happy to help make some connections.
Oh, really?
Yeah, absolutely.
Good. Some hearing, okay.
Actually,
I'd really like that. I think it could really help me, because I've done counseling. I've done all kinds of things to really work on my own personal growth. And I feel like, yeah, hey, that's another tool that might really be important in helping me kind of reach that fully dimensional human being at some point in my life.
Yeah, I mentioned it because I thought about it when I thought about the different tools you've developed from information to experience. And how probably if someone just reads the book or sees the template versus actually goes and accomplishes something in the full spectrum, you know, of an experience.
Yes.
And how much faster that happens versus, you know, something like talk therapy versus, you know, talk therapy when you're in a little bit different place.
And yeah.
Things along faster.
And I read Steve Jobs's book, the book written about him, and it was something like what was the greatest advice that you could, you know, give to somebody? He said, go out and do psychedelics. And I was just like, that guy was rad.
Yeah.
That was his one piece of advice that he gave to the world.
Yeah, it is. It's cool. It's been a huge part of my life and a lot of people in the group, but you mentioned integration, because like the downside too is some people just end up having too much fun with it and there's no integration.
Right.
And I've seen it in the opposite with like an addiction to personal development almost.
Yes.
I was coaching these some guys in some business stuff at one point, and I remember being like, you can't just go to workshops and retreats and stuff every single weekend without integrating them into daily life practices. Like, how does that affect, you know, the day-to-day and integrating those things, I think, is super, super important.
I've seen that exact thing, and that's what worried me about psychedelics in the beginning, because I see people do it and they get so far out there that they're not able to integrate it into their normal lives. And I'm like, no, I don't want to go there with it. Exactly like you said, I want to figure out how to make every moment more meaningful to me rather than just, you know, the summits and the big things.
Yeah, and I think that you'll find so many interesting parallels. And the timing is just cool now that research is available and it can be done in different settings, and extremely available, really interesting, fun time for that. Really cool. So like actually go into kind of to wrap up, so I can respect your time here, but integration and daily life. I'm super curious. You've accomplished a lot. You have this massive community and organization. You've done these amazing physical feats and still, you know, I have a feeling quite down to earth at home, even though you've got crazy ideas and seem to execute on and build teams around yourself. Like, what do you see for this next few chapters of life? Do you have your eyes set on anything particular? Is there, you know, what's doing in your mind for your next steps?
Well, I'm still physically climbing. I'm still climbing a lot and doing adventures around the world. I head to Alaska in May. I have these friends that every few years we get together and we have a near-death experience together. Mm-hmm. So I'm still climbing and still trying to hang in there. Things hurt a little bit more. You know, I've had more injuries. I had my finger totally rebuilt and, you know, back hurts a little bit, neck hurts a little bit, but I'm still physically hanging in there and climbing and doing these big adventures. So I hope to do that as long as I can, because I really do love it. And I hope to grow No Barriers into a household name. I really feel the world needs No Barriers. You know, not like cheesy motivational posters, but real, you know, the stories, the narratives, the lessons from real people, like that guy, Matt Burgess, who are sort of bleeding their way forward and trying to live this authentically meaningful life. That to me is so inspiring. We just made a film for No Barriers called From My Window. And we've helped Melissa Simpson. She's got cerebral palsy. She lives up in Leadville. And she looks out her window at these beautiful Rocky Mountains and probably, I don't know, never thought she would ever be on top of one of them. And so she came to us with that dream. And so we helped her get this this grip freedom chair developed by this amazing engineer from MIT. It's a kind of a hand cycle that you crank with your arms. It's a different, it's for really rugged, steep terrain. So we helped her get that. And then she trained on it. And then me and Jeff, who are No Barriers ambassadors, went up and we built a little team. It was like three blind people, a guy who had been blown up in Iraq, people who had fear and anxiety, and like they'd all lived the story. And we supported her and we cranked and pushed and pulled. And she stood on top of this 13,000 foot peak. And it was like the highlight of her life. And you know, she's looking for that No Barriers life. What does this mean for me? You know? And so, yeah, I hope to be a part of projects like that till the day I die. I love being a part of it. That day was the highlight of my COVID year. Just having her in this grip freedom chair. And, you know, she had trained so hard and she's on top of this 13,000 foot peak. And she can stand up real briefly. And she stood up out of her grip freedom chair and held her No Barriers flag. And it was powerful.
Oh, I believe it. Wow. And man, thank you so much for sharing all this and taking the time to come here. I know from, you know, the folks in our audience being a little different than the No Barriers audience, but also just humans as well. And everyone's got their stuff and the similarities here, but the pattern recognition that was going off my head just from the expeditions to building No Barriers and the different things that I think are applicable to so many of life situations, whether it's building a business or running your life or just dealing with adversity or celebrating your wins. You know, everyone can draw from that. And so, you know, it's awesome you've been a living example who's also decided to take the time and energy to share those stories. So I really appreciate it.
Awesome. Well, I loved our hour together. Yeah, I hope we get to hang out in person.
I'll
come up and scramble up Bear Mountain with you sometime.
Yeah, it'd be great. I'm down in Golden all the time at that little biohacking center, which might help with some of those aches and pains. So we can go.
Oh, I love it. Yeah. Yeah. When you're stopping through Golden, for sure. I'd love to. It'd be really great. Let's do it.
Sounds like a plan. Awesome. Thanks so much, man.
All right. Have a great afternoon. Bye.
Bye.